Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with Alan Phillips, attorney at law. It's another day, another Thursday, August 23, 2012. Thanks so much for listening and sharing these informative free broadcasts to get you up on the latest movements around vaccine rights, freedom of speech, your legal rights for exemptions and waivers, and just anything else on the social media network that we find fascinating and applicable to these topics. So on a wing and a prayer, we're going to do it again today. Hi, Alan.
Good afternoon, Debbie.
We've been getting somewhere between 500 and 1,000 views on these shows lately. So we're doing something right, and people are waking up, opening to the possibilities that what they're hearing on the mainstream media is not the full story. And that's why we're here.
And I want to remind people that we usually have the chat page
open.
On Blog Talk Radio. Debbie very attentively sees to that with every show. And that folks can also call in, and you can also email us in advance if there are particular questions or issues you'd like for us to discuss on the air. So we are happy to follow your lead, the listener, if there are particular things you would like us to address, particularly with vaccines and your rights, but even some related issues, as we're going to do a little bit today, Debbie.
Yes, we are going to talk about some related issues. I also want to inform folks that they can make a difference in the world simply by sharing, going on Twitter, letting other people know that we are here, putting click that Facebook button, put it on Dig, stumble upon Reddit. All of those social networks is where people learn about information. People are getting their news from the internet. They are not just hanging on to every word that's getting off of the radio or the television on mainstream media. So today I was considering this thought, the topic to be censorship. Everywhere I am reading about this issue, someone had tweeted the hashtag social media, and up comes this story about being censored in the news, especially in different places, not just Brazil, because Brazil had a Twitter blackout, but in India now there's a Twitter blackout and other social media. Why? And I think that there's good reason in certain instances. And I gave an example on one of my blogs that it was a follow-up for censoring like SOPA and all of those other issues that we had going on. So what's going on here? What's going on is that people, special interests, are manipulating the media. It's either the government or terrorist groups or other people. And so what I wrote was, we're gaming the system. Groups of people utilize the power of social network to game the system. They create a setting to touch people's emotions, to create a disturbance, to get people riled up in a small local community or even worldwide. And we see how that can spread like viral messages on the internet, like a viral video or a blog. So the one that's going on, I read on a website called The Hoot. It's a logo with an owl, I think a staying awake and alert at night. Could the government have been more transparent? How can websites defend themselves against a government ban? Clashes between government-sponsored and sponsorship and allowed messages versus special interest groups and the populace ended up in censorship of online media and blocking more than 250 sites that manipulated images and videos with the intent to fuel communal tensions between the Muslim and the Northeastern communities. How can we relate this to our topic always about vaccinations and your rights? I think the same thing, that we are being manipulated with information of what we're being given, handed on a silver platter, and what we have to go in the kitchen and get our own fresh, natural vegetables. Okay, I'm going to leave you with that thought.
Well, there are several different parts and pieces to this. It's very it is an inherently complex issue. Let me take a step back, because when we talk about censorship, one of the first things that people think about is, well, what about our right to free speech? Here in the United States, anyway, we have a First Amendment constitutional right to free speech. Now, like any other right, few, if any, rights are unbounded. They all have bump up against, at some point in some situation, an opposing right. And on just sort of a first brush level, the free speech right, speech is protected, but only up to a certain point. And that protection is really, really broad. And there was one particular U.S. Supreme Court case that just really underscores how broad this was. It was a 1969 case called Brandenburg v. Ohio versus Ohio. The court struck down a criminal conviction of a Ku Klux Klan group that was advocating violence as a means of accomplishing political reform. And one of the first things we think about with First Amendment free speech and what kind of speech maybe shouldn't be protected would be those things, those kinds of speech that are going to cause or risk serious harm. People should not just literally be able to say anything and everything and have it be okay. So the courts have determined certain areas of speech that are not protected. So it has to do with incitement, which I think is the thing we'll focus on mostly today. False information, obscenity is not protected, child pornography, fighting words and offensive speech, threats, things like that. There are lines that are drawn in the law where there are certain kinds of speech which aren't protected. And most of us would probably agree, at least in general terms, from just sort of a common sense place, that there's a point where these different kinds of categories of speech shouldn't be protected. But what was interesting to me in this Supreme Court case, the 1969 case that I just mentioned, the Ku Klux Klan had been convicted because for advocating violence as a means of accomplishing political reform. The Supreme Court reversed that decision, struck down the criminal conviction, because the Ku Klux Klan's statements at a rally did not express an immediate or imminent intent to do violence. And so in this arena, you know, people, you can go on the internet or out in public and you can advocate reform, and you can advocate extreme reform. And under this ruling, it looks like you can even advocate extreme means of accomplishing the reform, so long as you're not expressing an immediate or imminent intent to do violence. And so this kind of a line, and this happens in the law generally, I think, in many, many different areas, where we have these standards or these lines, if you will, that are created as concepts expressed in words. And they have to one extent or another, many times, be generalized so as to be able to apply to a wide variety of hypothetical future situations, each one of which is going to ultimately be specific and different from every other one. And so necessarily there's some judgment involved. How, and the question that immediately comes in my mind, well, who gets to judge? Usually that's not you or me. That's going to be a court ultimately if there's a formal dispute. But who gets to judge? Who gets to decide what does and doesn't qualify? And where should those lines be drawn? And these are all things that reasonable people can disagree on, but that ultimately we have, as a society, have to have a way for a system in place to make those kind of decisions. That's, of course, what our courts do when we have formal disputes.
A lot of times the line is not so clear because of false information. And for instance, what I was talking about in India, we're talking about photoshopping images and putting out false information. And also for vaccines, and we've said this so many times on every show, the information that the government and the mainstream media is putting out is censoring the alternative evidence for vaccines to do harm. So on both sides of the fence, both the public or the small interest groups plus the government or the pharmacy companies are also putting out false information. Who's going to be able to filter that information?
Well, and this raises a real interesting point. I mean, I think our civilization today and society is in and of itself inherently complex, and I think our legal systems mirror that complexity. But it gains a whole new level, additional level of complexity when you throw into the mix human beings and their dysfunctions or propensities or willingness to do things out of a lack of integrity. So, for example, I often tell people that my personal opinion and my legal opinion are sometimes very different. So you and I, Debbie, could say would agree in general terms, at least a high level of agreement, that a lot of information that the pharmaceutical industry and the government puts out about vaccines is false. Isn't that something that should be then unlawful? And it's just sort of a basic common sense assessment of that. Of course it should be, but it probably isn't. And why not?
And they're protecting themselves with new laws. That's one of the things they're doing.
I'll give you an example. If you were either legally in court or in any other sense or capacity, you say, well, I want to call this particular pharmaceutical spokesperson or government official. I want to call them on this. They keep telling us that vaccines are safe and effective, but they're not, and here's the evidence, blah, blah, blah. These people can turn around and point to studies in the medical literature that support their position. You know, the CDC makes all kinds of statements that I think are blatantly false in some cases, and in other cases highly suspect or at least misleading on its website, and that ought to be something that they can't do or can't get away with. And ultimately, I don't think they should be able to and should be called on it. We need to find a way to follow through and, you know, see that ultimately that truth and integrity prevail. And as much as possible, justice for people who deliberately disseminate false and knowingly disseminate false information.
I put a little example of that where I think that it is really rightfully so that a law should be put in place. And that is the example of when somebody goes into a movie theater and yells fire, and there isn't a fire. And that's, you know, getting people up agitated and chaotic and can induce some sort of havoc and damage and hurt to all the people there. And that is against the law, right?
It is. It's one of the classic examples that we talk about in law school when this issue comes up about free speech, where are the boundaries and what is appropriate and inappropriate. And there have been instances where people have for whatever reason or reasons, made false statements that have caused substantial or serious harm or even death as a result. You know, people in a movie theater, somebody yells fire, at least in some instances in decades past, that would cause a panic. People would rush out and people get trampled. and potentially property damaged and in the process and so forth. So that's a example of simple example, an obvious example of where that should not be protected speech. In fact, that should be unlawful speech. But what concerns me, to bring it back to the vaccine issue, you can point to studies in the medical literature that will support the mainstream view on vaccines. And the question then becomes, for those of us who want to dig a little deeper, well, is that reliable information and so forth? And you can find out fairly quickly, even as a layperson in the medical sense of the word, there's all kinds of information to support the possibility, if not outright probability, or in some specific instances, fact that certain medical studies are just not correct or not reliable. And yet, it has become the standard for the federal agencies and state agencies to base policy and law, and it's perfectly appropriate in the structure of our legal system to do that. So there are obviously deep fundamental flaws in the system as it currently exists. And those flaws need to be identified, addressed, lights shone on them. I have a huge one that I've been dealing with recently here in North Carolina, Debbie. If I give you a quick example, and it might be a little bit off the point, so feel free to reel me in. But as you know, Debbie, we've talked about in shows in the past, we have a law here in North Carolina that allows children of any age to consent to vaccines and other medical treatment. And that law, I'm not going to go into the details today, but that law violates or conflicts with four state and federal constitutional provisions and four state and federal statutory provisions, and those are just the ones that I've identified. And I've written a legal memorandum in detail about that on the vaccinerights.com website for any listeners who want to go see the details on that. When I discussed that with my state senator, and all representatives, state representatives around the country, take oaths to uphold the state and federal constitutions, my representative did not argue with me about whether or not this was unconstitutional. She accepted that. But her response is, I can't help you. We have the University of North Carolina hospitals in our district. Well, what in the world does that have to do with you keeping your oath? So the system, just as another example, that the system in place pretends to be one with integrity, but at very deep levels is flawed and corrupt and is not a system of integrity. The systems we have are not systems of integrity. They are systems that have been perhaps slowly over many decades, but nonetheless, however it occurred, the result that we have today is systems in place that have been co-opted by industry or others with private agendas or personal agendas, using the public governments as means of achieving those agendas. And so on the one hand, the system is set up so that bad things are legal, to put it in very simplistic terms.
I can give you an example. Yesterday, I want to thank Dr. Muhammad Rafiq on HWC, Homeopathy World Community, who wrote a blog, Call for Action Against Unethical Clinical Trials in Kerala, India. And it goes on to this situation where the government is giving free medication to the public, and it's really a clinical trial because those medications, those drugs, have never really been thoroughly tested. And so there, I can give you the link to that. I'll put it on the chat. And it really gets down deep into something that's been going on for many, many decades, that there's this partnership between industry and government that is really not spoken of fully, and clearly, and people are calling for transparency, that India has become a global hub for clinical trials on human subjects, reportedly worth $400 million and growing by 30% per year. And what's happening is the poor indigent people who are taking these drugs are really dying and getting hurt. And this is not just happening in India, although it's greatly happening there. We have many instances in history where the same thing has been done. I have a list on that same website article called Top 10 Unethical Research Programs in U.S. History. Anywhere from animal testing, entomological warfare, overseas drug trials, it's going on in the with the our veterans, with our military. It's going on with eugenic sterilization programs and radiation and germ warfare. And the biggest one we know is the syphilis experiments, the Great Imitator is what it's called. So if you want to find out more about that, you can go to that blog.
You know, Natural News just ran an article recently talking about how pharmaceutical giant Pfizer has agreed to pay a $60 million fine to settle charges filed against Pfizer alleging illegal bribery. And according to CNN Money, so this comes from a reputable mainstream source, initially both Pfizer and Wyeth, and Wyeth since recently merged with Pfizer, that they paid off foreign officials in Europe and Asia to speed up drug approvals. And this is something that gave preference to Pfizer's drugs in many of these continents, countries, in their public health programs, which in turn generated billions of dollars for the world's largest drug company. Now, tell me, how much of a disincentive is it to be fined $60 million when the crime that you committed has generated billions of dollars? So I'm really trying to figure out, you know, what the point is. And we've talked repeatedly on the show about how criminal fines as high as $1 billion in a couple of instances. And by the way, one of those $1 billion criminal fines was the same company, Pfizer, back in 2009 for illegal marketing of drugs. And I know I've said this before, Debbie, but I think it bears underscoring. You don't get a criminal fine for something that you did accidentally. You know, they knew what they were doing. They did it anyway. In the case of Pfizer, back in 2009, they got this $1 billion criminal fine. In part, it was that high because it was the fourth time they'd been caught doing the same thing since 2002. Well, here they are again now paying a $60 million fine, which is just chicken feed to them for the compared to the billions that they're getting for the illegal behavior. This behavior obviously is not going to stop, even with a $1 billion criminal fine and $1.3 billion civil fine that went with that to Pfizer back in 2009. They're just going to keep doing the same kind of stuff over and over again. I have said before, and I will say repeatedly in the future, I'm sure, this is an industry that routinely engages in criminal behavior. We know that by the documented instances in which they've been caught doing it and paid these, in some cases, hundreds of millions or even as much as $1 billion criminal and civil fines. What is it going to take to stop this?
You're leading me into, you know, I like to kind of give people some encouragement. We want to have solutions. And one of the things I think that just the general population can do is use their pocketbook as their means of voting. Don't take these drugs. Don't willingly. I mean, I know people are suffering. I know people are in pain, but they're going to have to take the harder road and look inside. And I just read an article about a woman who, a famous model, who was given the diagnosis of cancer, and she was told she was supposed to do chemo, and instead she just totally turned her diet around. She eliminated meat, she eliminated dairy, she eliminated things, and she put in vitamin C and all these other things, and it's as if she did her own nutritional natural chemo. And these are the kinds of things people are going to have to not buy into it. And then the industries will get the message that way. The other way, of course, is to pinpoint and target the people who are at the top and somehow get them to be responsible. You know, take the consequences, not pass it off to some sort of insurance that they have, oh, we'll spend this much, but we're going to get this much in profit.
I'm not sure what the impact in terms of public perception is when you have somebody, for one thing, we see some of these fines and things that go on with the pharmaceutical industry. We don't see generally much mention of that in the mainstream news, or even there was one, the Wall Street Journal actually pulled an article that one of their writers had written and put up on the internet about pharmaceutical recent $1 billion fine. trying to remember if that, I think it was Glaxo that was the second company just very recently this year to get a $1 billion criminal fine. And for them, it was accompanied by a $2 billion civil fine, which made it the largest fine ever under the Federal False Claims Act. And so there's some attempt, first of all, to suppress widespread knowledge of those kinds of events. But second of all, you know, like I said, this Natural News article said it, that this was according to CNN Money, so this was getting out through some mainstream news outlets. Is the perception then that drug companies are bad because of this, or that the problems are considered to be few and infrequent and they've gotten handled because they paid the fine and now everything's okay? I certainly agree with you, Debbie, absolutely, that people need to vote with their wallets, and we need to do that in all areas of our lives as much as we can. I know in my own life there are times where I feel like I'm not able to do that, not in the medical arena, but in other arenas. I don't necessarily want to support certain things, and yet I find that for reasons financial or otherwise, sometimes I have to compromise that hypothetical ideal. But I'm skeptical, and that's certainly a part of a total solution, but I'm skeptical that in and of itself over the short term is going to have an impact, a significant impact on what's going on, and I would love to be proved wrong on that.
I have to hang my hat on something. I have to give some positive energy out there, because everything around us, I mean, the GMO labeling, we don't have, you know, complete information. If we have a half-truth, if something says it's natural, but really the soy protein in it is GMO and it's not labeled anywhere, how are people to know? They're going to assume this particular product that I trust and use and know for the past now is contains something that is not what I really want. And it goes across the board in our supermarket, in our department stores, on who's making these products, and in the drugs, in the pharmacy stores. I mean, no matter where you go, you have to be on the alert. You have to be thinking and conscious about your choices.
Well, the place that I keep coming back to in all of our discussions is that it's important for us to be taking as many reasonable steps as we can, first of all, to be informed and to stay informed, because these are all evolving issues, changing over time, there's new information, but also to become legislatively active, because one of the strongest ways we have of voicing our opinion, in addition to voting with your wallet, which is something we can all do immediately and today, and so that's something that's really wonderful about that concept, Debbie, as I think about it now, really glad for that and other reasons that you brought it up, but also to become legislatively active. When we see that there is legislation being attempted to be pushed through at the state or federal level that would, for example, require or prevent requiring labeling of GMOs, we need to recognize that the obvious common sense thing is often what loses at the legislative level unless we get out there and fight for it. And I tell you, I have really mixed emotions sometimes with my legislative efforts and activism, Debbie, because sometimes I feel like we're fighting for things that don't make any sense on a common sense level that we should have to fight for in the first place. It's obvious to me that any product should list all of its ingredients, end of story. What is there to debate about that?
It shouldn't be a debate. It should be an obvious right. Why is there a question? Why?
Yeah, but the practical reality is there are people with opposing agendas who are fighting hard to keep that from happening. And so the bottom line is freedom and is something that requires constant vigilance and constant activity, action, participation. Because there are, among us, in the human race as it exists today, people who will look for and seek to and actively pursue their own personal or private agendas or ends at whatever cost it may be to others in the process of getting there. And it's so difficult for many of us to wrap our mind around the possibility that there are intelligent people who would behave that way. But the reality is that there are. very aggressive and very intelligent people,
and powerful people, and with a lot of backing and funding. And you know, this is everywhere. It depends on people to not be apathetic and to take a stand by going out into these alternative spheres and learning about what's going on. You know, you mentioned this morning to me something that I had gotten also a message, and I believe it must be going viral, this Marine veteran who's detained for posting about conspiracies on Facebook. And this person is not inciting, like you quoted the what did you say it was, the Brandenburg versus Ohio. I mean, he's not inciting people to violence. He's just voicing his opinion as anyone else's. And they are
I'm not sure about that. According to ABC, he put up a statement, "Sharpen up my axe, I'm here to sever heads."
Uh-huh.
Now, that kind of a line to me, now I haven't seen the actual posting, but just looking at that line out of context, to me, that sounds like the sort of thing that would be said in that way as a figure of speech and not a literal threat.
It was a song it was a song lyrics. I think it was a song lyric, so it's not, people put up song lyrics. People are, you know, and they have a little picture of him holding a puppy in his hand, you know, like, here's this nice little sweet guy, and he's not allowed to have a private conversation in a private room. That is one of the other things, because sometimes on Facebook, that's your personal space, but it's actually, he was being censored. I wanted to bring it back to the theme of censorship. Did I lose you?
I temporarily lost you. I thought I had to call back in, but it turned out I was still connected. So I didn't hear all of what you just said, but let me respond.
I was saying that, you know, on this website that I'm looking at, they show a picture of Brandon Raub with a very sweet face and smile and a camp holding a puppy dog. You know, like, this is a nice guy, a nice young guy with a family that was just voicing his opinion on a private space on Facebook. Now, who has the right to go into his private conversation? You know, that's another thing.
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, this raises a lot of questions, and I don't have clear answers here, although I'm sure there are lots of people who feel strongly one side or the other of this particular issue. But I think for our purposes, it raises some really important questions and issues. You know, Facebook is often a place that people go to have private conversations with their friends or coworkers or whatever, people they decide who has access to their page and so forth, although many of Facebook pages, whether intentionally or not, are left open to the general public. And so it's an interesting question, in what language, in what context is really a threat or not, and who gets to decide that, and is somebody making a decision not based on an objective view of the speech, for example, for free speech purposes, but maybe because they have an agenda that is contrary to this person's views. Of course, that's the way this has been interpreted by most people, probably in the alternative community. Here's somebody who had alternative or the minority 9/11 views that were anti-government, and so there might have been some reason for the person, someone making an assessment, to censor this person. Well, let's just set an example. So
exactly,
you know,
when you said
for the 9/11.
Set an example. That is the main thing. You know, you kind of put somebody up as the scapegoat, so that other people become afraid to speak.
But I tell you, based on just the cursory view of the Supreme Court case I mentioned, where even the Ku Klux Klan at a rally was ultimately deemed within their rights to talk about using violence to change policy and law, so long as they weren't doing that in a way that sounded like they were getting ready to go right out now and commit violence, or others should right now go and commit violence. And I'm not sure this line, "Sharpen up my axe, I'm here to sever heads," really suggests that this is somebody who's about to go out and start literally doing that. If he started naming individuals that he was going to go commit horrendous acts on, that would be a much more serious thing. But it, you know, we can always.
Can I ask one question regarding that Brandenburg versus Ohio and the way it was turned over? In what year did that occur? Because I think over the decades, our society, the American society, has changed so radically that we were more on a liberal kind of thinking, if you had a doubt about somebody, you weren't guilty until proven, you know, what is it? Is that the statement?
Yeah, you're innocent until proven guilty, which the concept about
that I don't think is true anymore.
Well, I think it's become less and less true. That's a really good point. This was the decision in Brandenburg v. Ohio was in 1969. That was the, you know, more or less the height of the 1960s.
A revolutionary period in our history, really.
Absolutely. Much as those of us who lived through it would prefer not to think of it as really being that long ago that we could actually call it history, but it is at this point.
Right, and I think we've changed completely. We've swung the other way. We've created so many limitations, restrictions, and boundaries on what we can say.
But I want to be fair here, though. I want to give the other side of the issue, because there's many instances where people have caused harm, and we've looked back and said there were signs there that we should have paid attention to and that we missed. And so there is a place for the better safe than sorry position. Now, this Marine was apparently has been ordered to be locked up for 30 days so he can be evaluated and they can see if he's okay or whatever. I don't, you know, I'm not familiar with the details in the story, so I don't have an opinion about whether that was a proper decision or not. But it sounds to me like a relatively extreme decision, unless there was some real clear speech on his part indicating some very likely imminent harm. But how many times have we heard, you know, again, somebody say, oh, the signs were there. If we'd only paid attention, we could have gotten this child help before they committed suicide or whatever the issue is. And it's real easy to, and there's a tendency for those of us in the alternative community to interpret things as an attack. Sometimes I think without giving fair consideration to the other side, if this ends up being a guy who's really okay, we're all going to be relieved. Have his rights been violated on a personal level, but on a larger level, is this a standard we want to take? How, you know, where do you draw the line and you say we just can't take a chance here? I know it's a different topic, but just as a same concept, with one of my own children several years ago, he had either written or drawn something in school that could reasonably be interpreted as this child potentially being suicidal, but it was an isolated event. The teachers are required, if they see anything, you know, that hints of it, they have to make an issue out of it. The kid has to be checked out and so forth. I mean, it didn't end up into any huge, enormous event like happened with this Marine. But we would want, you know, it was annoying, but I was grateful that, first of all, that it was brought to my attention as that child's parent. I was grateful that we looked into it, because we have all heard the stories, or if we haven't, hear it now, of children who gave us signals that we didn't recognize or ignored or didn't think were serious, and then we find them suspended, you know, with a noose somewhere or whatever. And so,
yeah, we hear it almost every day, Alan, in the news about kids who are on antidepressants and Ritalin and this and that and go out and commit some horrendous deed.
Well, there's a whole separate question about when these acts are influenced by medication. That's a separate topic and one worthy of exploration, absolutely.
Right, but those are the kids that, you know, very often the neighbors say, no, there was nothing, he was a nice guy or a nice girl, and they didn't notice that anything was off, or maybe they did notice, like you said, signals and cues that were not being paid enough attention to, and they were ignoring them, the guidance counselors in the school, because we just don't have enough staff, or everybody is overwhelmed. You know, there's so many reasons. Go ahead.
Yeah, there are the situations that slip through the cracks for, you know, or situations where there weren't really any red flags anywhere, and those are even more troubling because we didn't even have the opportunity to see it. But you've got something like this situation with the Marine. There's going to be a judge looking at the evidence that's being presented, and that person, you know, being a judge, has to exercise judgment. And there are many situations where reasonable people will disagree, and therefore, whatever the judgment, some people on one side or the other, depending on where the decision lands, there are going to be people who object to it. Oh, they shouldn't have let that guy go. What if he turns out to be an axe murderer?
Right.
Oh, they shouldn't have locked him up. He's a really nice guy. And so I think we need to have a little patience and a little deference to recognize that even when something raises a question for us, what's going on here, is this really a serious issue or not, that there is a range of reasonable judgment. Inherent in the nature and practice of law is that we have these boundaries or standards that are defined by words that necessarily cannot be precise, at least in some instances. And so somebody has to make a judgment call. Somebody has to interpret these words, this standard, against this set of facts as presented in the evidence. Our legal system, at times and ways, tries to do things that, at least in an ideal or absolute sense, are impossible as a purely practical matter. And so, to one degree or another, our legal system is often something the actions of which and the results of which are approximations, almost in some instances necessarily by definition. So you have a standard that if somebody's speech is deemed to be inciting immediate violent action, then it's not protected and probably is unlawful. Well, every case is going to be different. Every case that comes up is going to be a different set of words in a different context in a different setting, and every one of them, somebody has to, if it becomes a formal case, someone has to ultimately exercise judgment. And any time that judgment can be exercised, you are going to potentially have as many different judgments as there are people who would be making the judgment.
Can I make a statement there?
Sure,
about
sure.
That? A lot of what you're saying, I agree, you know, wholeheartedly. We should oftentimes err on the side of caution to protect the people who are involved or innocent people. What concerns me is this issue of censorship. So let's say you take this story about the Marine, and if we didn't have the alternative media and our personal emails and the ability to communicate amongst ourselves so that we do shine a light on this particular case, to say by doing it and highlighting and informing the government that we know it's happening, that Marine is being protected from, let's say, you know, if they're being having their mental status questioned, that they're not being given drugs, that they're not being put in a situation where they may go off the deep end. You know what I'm saying? That sometimes when a person is locked up, we don't know what happens behind the door. And what I'm talking about is the ability of people to communicate freely and learn about what's happening in their own community and environment without loss of information, and also protecting these guys who are going to be the scapegoats.
Well, I don't have information in this particular case about whether he's being kept from family or visitors.
I don't really know anything about. I'm just using it as an analogy. I'm just using it as a case study, that when people are taken away and nobody knows about it and they're put behind closed doors, you don't know what's going on back there. And
well,
that's what I'm saying, that the fact that this is a public issue now because it's gone viral on the internet, then the people who are doing all of this stuff have got to watch their P's and Q's. They have to do it cleanly, you know? That's kind of what I'm saying.
Because they're under the light. But you're saying that there are other instances where this kind of thing happens and
nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying. I'm saying that's why I'm highlighting today the theme of censorship. Who does the government have the right to censor certain things that takes it away from the public eye so that we cannot speak out and support one way or the other to say, you know, you better watch out what you do to this person behind that we don't know what you're doing. That's kind of what I'm saying, that we need to have this freedom on the internet.
Well, clearly the government does censor information. That's perhaps because of my own areas of focus, that's no more evident to me anywhere else than, although I'm sure absolutely not by any means limited to, the issue of vaccines. You know, we can I could cite examples of, as we talked about before, where the CDC has been caught with their pants down, where they've been caught giving misinformation and either deliberate, flat-out false information or misleading information. This is just something that government agencies do, and we've talked about the Union for Concerned Scientists a few years ago surveyed federal agency scientists across the board and found out that it's routine practice for federal agencies to suppress scientific information or falsify results of scientific studies or to enact policy directly contrary to the findings of their own scientists. So this is stuff that has been documented. It's probably still not well known and well acknowledged and as far as the general public is concerned, but that's probably in part because of deliberate efforts to confuse or suppress or deny that kind of information. So that, as we keep saying over and over again, and sometimes in different ways, there is far-reaching corruption. But part of the corruption and the control of the system has been to design the system in such a way that it supports or enables the continued misuse, abuse of the system, the continued corruption. The system is self-perpetuating. There's an egg there that we need to crack. And we have huge potential with the alternative media. You know, people have said in the past, what can we do to get the truth about vaccines in the mainstream media? And my response to that is two part. The first part is, as a first general matter, yes, I'm all for getting the truth about vaccines on mainstream media. But you know what? The public is increasingly going to the internet to get its information. So maybe the basket we should be putting our eggs in, or more of our eggs in, is to develop the electronic media systems and communication on that level, because people are increasingly going there.
That's exactly my point. The government is totally, totally aware that people are getting their information, not even going to the doctor, but self-diagnosing themselves and finding answers to their problems on the internet. And my point is, since that's happening, governments are now censoring the internet.
Well, this is an issue I've seen come across my screen repeatedly in the last several months, if not a few years, where increasingly there are efforts, for example, by some representatives in Congress to introduce or pass laws that restrict freedom of speech on the internet or would enable or increase business and industry control over the internet, ultimately leaning or moving in the direction of the same people who are controlling the so-called mainstream media. For the exact same reasons, want to control internet communication as well. So it seems, when you think about it, really obvious that they would need and want and try need for their purposes and be taking steps to accomplish and achieve that. So we need to be, again, vigilant. We need to be aware and active. We need to be paying attention and getting in those loops, such as Yahoo groups or Internet Facebook pages or other social media and electronic media, so that we can become aware of these issues as they are taking place. Because if we don't step up and stand out and speak up, and many times that only takes a few seconds. I'm on a lot of different lists where I'll get an email that says, such and such an issue, go to this page and sign the petition or contact your representatives or whatever it is. And so many of these days on the Internet are systematized in a way that it really only takes a couple minutes of your time to participate. So nobody can, no longer do we have the luxury, if that's the word, of saying, well, you know, I don't have time to take on a part-time job of leading an initiative to support or oppose legislation at the state or federal level. I just don't have time for that. Well, who does? Very few of us. But most of us can find, I would say virtually all of us can find, you know, 2 minutes or 3 minutes to go to a website that will automatically connect us with our state representatives. They'll even write the letters for you now many times, and you just modify it if you want to or send it as is.
And I recommend people do more than that, because that is having less and less impact. I mean, millions of these petitions, signatures go out, and still things fail. And I think partially it's you have to walk up face-to-face with your representative. You have to send him a snail mail letter. You have to call him on the phone, and you're going to get a secretary or something to automate get your answer. But still, there are other means besides just clicking a button on a web page poll. I think that does something, but very small amount,
I think it depends on the specific issue. I mean, I've had times when I've written to representatives and either got nothing back or gotten a formal letter back, so the physical letter was a complete waste of time. I've also seen instances where I get emails saying, we succeeded thanks to you and the 100,000 other people who went to our website and clicked this button to send something off. You know, we were able to defeat this bill. So it really depends on the specific situation. I do agree with you to the extent that I hear what you're saying, or that I might, let's put it this way.
What I'm saying is, yes,
more is definitely better. If you can take the time to write a letter or make the phone call or send the fax, I think that's better than clicking the button and sending an email. But what's most effective generally in any situation is having large numbers of people doing whatever it is they do. Collectively, I think, is where we make a bigger difference. And that's why, even if it's all electronic, if you have, you know, a million people doing it, you're going to get some attention. If you have 25
maybe even,
people,
maybe even the mainstream media will pick up on it if you do something of that. Yeah.
But if you have 25 people send letters, that's not likely to overwhelm any state or federal legislator. So it really just, you know, but do whatever you can do. My point is, something is better than nothing in every instance. And if you're able to do more, I would say go for it. You know, I do have those emails that come along that say, don't say go to my site and click the button. They say, please call your representatives. That will probably have a stronger impact than just sending an email, for the very reason that you point out, because anybody can click something, so it may not be as meaningful to get a...
Unless you do have many millions, but, you know, even
right.
on the GMOs, it hasn't worked. But we have to keep at it, even if it didn't work one time. So let's give some announcements. I want to tell you that on Monday on the Health In Show, the guest is going to be Amnon Nissan of Nissan Communications, the producer of our shows, talking about cyberbullying and how to respond to those types of attacks, because skeptics are out there, other people in force are out there writing nasty comments on your blogs if they are of an opposing factor. And so what can you do as a person who keeps your own website or does do a blog or is active on the Internet? I think it's going to be exciting. And then on Wednesday, we have the Dr. Adil Sachin Thalawala Kasim. We'll be back again to answer listeners' questions. Just like on this show, we would love to have people send us a message. What question do you want to have answered? Because we take up over an hour with Dr. Adil talking about the questions that are sent in from all around the world. And then we have your show. So those are our shows for the weekend. I encourage people to go to HWC. One more thing. I've changed the discount code for anybody who's interested in the homeopathic remedies, books, kits, anything like that. Miranda Castro has provided a new discount code. The old one wasn't working, but it's going to be extended from this summer to the entire end of this year. So check that out on HWC. And tell us about your vaccine work and how to connect with you, Alan.
Well, sure. And this can pertain to questions on the air or off the air. There are so many different areas where the question arises, how do I legally avoid vaccines, not just schools, but we have issues with public schools, private schools, homeschoolers, military schools. All of those can involve different areas of law, colleges and college programs, where healthcare programs, where the students have to do clinical work in local hospitals. All different areas of law that can apply in each of these areas. There's military members, families, and children. There's immigration, which includes foreign adoption. There are what I call vaccine custody disputes, where parents split up and disagree about vaccinating the kids. All these different areas where questions and issues come up about vaccine exemptions and vaccine rights, and all of these are addressed in my ebook called The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, available at vaccinerights.com. Lots of free information available there as well, and contact information. Again, that's vaccinerights.com, and I encourage folks to go there and check out the information, and feel free to contact me about any of your individual concerns about vaccine rights. But if you have questions you want to see us or issues you want to see us address on the air, email me as well or give me a call. Be glad to have the show focus on your concerns.
Right, and let folks know that you do the talking circuit. You know, if anybody is having an event, a conference, and they need a spokesperson, somebody to get up and either teach, educate, all the things that you do, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, basically, anywhere that we can work out the logistics, if somebody wants me to talk and has an audience, I've done everything from talk to five mothers in somebody's living room to speak at international conferences, looking to get out more to speak to people, to help inform people about the vaccine rights issues, including exemptions and waivers, but also the legislative issues and concerns, because that is a hot topic these days. Laws are being passed very quickly around the country to require more vaccines and to restrict our right to refuse them. And so these are all important issues, and I'm happy to talk about any or all of them.
And two other things. One is that people can read many of your articles on Natural News with Mike Adams, and you are prominently displayed there when I get my newsletter from there, so you can read about what you've been doing legislatively and current events. Then also you've got a Monday evening show that's been going on maybe 3 weeks now with Meyer Eisenstein. Tell me who it is again.
Yeah, Dr. Meyer Eisenstein, who is not only a medical doctor and an alternative one and a wonderful human being, also is a member of the Illinois Bar and has a master's in public health. He has an amazing background and amazing history of many decades of treating children in his clinics without pushing vaccines. And they have an amazingly low, in fact, he says none that he knows of, autistic kids after 30 years in his clinics treating some 30,000 kids. They don't vaccinate there. And that speaks volumes right there in and of itself. But that's every Monday night on Blog Talk Radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. But then it's also rebroadcast now 4 in the afternoons on Wednesday afternoons at naturalnewsradio.com.
So the word is getting out. And I really want to thank you for spending this hour with us. We're going to end, and we'll see you next Thursday. We'll have a great lineup of news and information, and please send us your questions. Share it on Twitter, on Facebook, and everywhere else. Okay, take care, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips, and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Your truth be unfurled one by one.